Welcome to Wildlife Rehabilitation from Rescue to Release, a podcast dedicated to licensed wildlife rehabilitators and the veterinarians who support them. I'm your host, Gail Buell.
Techniques we discuss here are meant for licensed wildlife professionals. If you aren't licensed and trained for wildlife rehabilitation, do not attempt to capture, hold, or rehabilitate any wild animal. If you find an injured wild animal, a wildlife professional can recommend next steps. We will tackle topics about rescue, care, management, reconditioning, and releasing wildlife found in North America. This is a deep dive into each subject. We hope to give rehabilitators information they can use because they're already going to great lengths to rescue and nurse animals back to health. There are three possible outcomes in wildlife rehabilitation: release, euthanasia, and placement. An injured or orphaned wild animal's journey to restored health and independence in their natural habitat is delicate and complex. We draw techniques and expertise from many disciplines. Many animals brought into rehabilitation cannot be saved. The last gift we can give them is humane euthanasia. We'll talk more about when this is necessary. Sometimes animals are deemed non-releasable and evaluated to be suitable for a life in captivity. When that happens, we shift to a long-term approach to managing their care, training, and housing. Some such animals serve as ambassador animals, a term for animals that rehabilitators use to educate the public. Each episode, we'll speak with experts who represent specialty topics across the profession of wildlife rehabilitation, ambassador animal care and management, showcasing best practices. Hey everyone, welcome back. I, of course, am very excited about our guest today. I am talking to Deborah Galley, and we are going to talk about cottontail rabbits. But I'm going to let her give her version of her background, her origin story, since I tend to ask that quite a bit. Welcome, Deborah. So happy that you've agreed to be on the podcast with me.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here. Anytime I can share information, I'm always happy.
Excellent. Excellent. Deborah, could you give for everybody a little bit of your origin story? How did you get to this spot? And we're going to talk about cottontail rabbits today. So how did you get to this
spot? Actually, very interesting. Mm-hmm. I started my career in retail management. Then I was in philanthropy. So I was doing a lot of philanthropic events in New York City and around some high-end events. Then I went to corporate, and kind of in the middle, I was in corporate and philanthropic. And I was with corporate for 10 years at Time Warner. And my dream has always been to work with animals. And I decided to make a change and step out, which was very difficult. Uh-huh. So I started by taking, believe it or not, veterinary assistant certification course. Okay. And the first day of my class, I met a wildlife rehabilitator. I didn't even know that was available in my state. And that was it. Mm-hmm. I was down the road, and that was in 2010, I think. So that's how I started. And my way of learning, I wanted to learn as much as I could, but mm-hmm. I thought I would pick, I worked under my mentor, the person from my class, with raccoons, with skunks, with squirrels, with flyers, with rabbits. So I worked with a gamut of mammals, and I decided to take on the rabbits because I had had pet rabbits, and I have, I believe, a gift for rabbits for some reason, and I don't know why, but they take to me, which I know they can be very difficult to deal with, and they're not as hardy as the other animals, and I probably approach them with a little gentler feel because I don't do the other animals, so I'm only doing the little rabbits, not like I go from one to the other, which is really hard to switch gears.
Yeah, I am not a rabbit person. And I've met people that are, like you, very much attuned to the rabbits and how to approach them and all that kind of stuff. And I call it going into your zen.
Yes.
And being able to just calm down, be very present in the moment, and be able to work then with their rhythms. I can't do that.
That's why I say it's kind of a gift. I don't know if you develop it. I don't know. But I do know that when I come home from work, because I work full time, and it's very stressful because I work in a 24/7 emergency facility that's like the number one around in the state. And or maybe I shouldn't say that, but it's a high end facility.
It's very busy.
it's Cornell. So, you know, the stress level with what we see coming in every single day, we never see the cute little puppies that just come in for their vaccination. We always see, you know, the really high stress situations, emergency surgery, get them in, you know, those kinds of things. So for me coming home and then having to sit and feed rabbits, it's like, I can feel the tension in my hands. And rabbits, remember, are very low on the food chain. So they are attuned to everything. And even though you're holding one, they can't see, right? Because his eyes are closed, their ears are back. They can still sense. They were born that way. Right. You know, I believe that they still know if I'm really tense, they're going to know that I'm really tense and I'm not going to get them to eat.
Right. Right. And it could be that if you had worked with, when you were working with them up to that point, and you know, you were in that Zen place and now you're really tense for whatever reason, it could be just that you feel different to them and they're like, wait a second.
Something's wrong. And they may feel in my, you know, I don't know, how does your blood pulse? You know, how does your blood pressure? You know, things like that they feel.
You're holding them,
we don't feel. So I have to like really go into a Zen before I can touch the rabbits. I won't touch them until I like, you know, Zen. I might even have to have a glass of wine. Whatever it is to take me down a notch, I have to do it.
Sure. And that's just a pro tip. We're going to be talking about pro tips. Have a glass of wine before your rabbits.
I don't recommend more than one because remember, you're dealing with rabbits and they're very quick. And it's also easy to aspirate them. Just a plug.
Just a plug. We have to moderate that just a little bit. But I thought I'd put that in there. So here I'm going to ask, so you're in Connecticut and doing rabbit rehabilitation. And I know that you've had to deal with this question before, maybe from other rehabilitators, but more than likely not rehabilitators, but the general public, maybe the Department of Fish and Game or Department of Natural Resources, whatever. Why rehabilitate rabbits? They're everywhere.
And that's a good question. But I believe that any species should be rehabilitated if it's possible and be given a second chance. Also, rabbits represent a huge food source. So while you say rabbits are everywhere, I know personally where I live now, no one had seen rabbits for years because I'm sure they were picked off by the bobcats and everything else. Mm-hmm. And then Deborah arrived and she's released several rabbits in her backyard. And now that I hear people, I mean, I see people on like Facebook saying, oh my gosh, there's a rabbit in my yard.
Wow.
So, you know, yes, that becomes, you know, now it's replenished or, the, you know, the food chain. Obviously, they're going to be eaten at some point. But I do believe that every animal deserves the chance. And especially because most of the time, the human aspect is the cause of them being in rehab.
Right. The anthropogenic.
And when you go down that road, it's not natural. You know, if it's a natural event, that's different. But when it's your lawnmower or your dog digs up a nest, now it becomes something that's a people issue.
Right.
It's not a, and the animal does deserve that right.
Yeah. We're in what's called the anthropogenic age right now. And that's because humans are just, we impact everything, everything. So no, I totally agree. And, cottontails are not like an endangered or threatened species, but there are many rabbits that are. Species of rabbit that are endangered or threatened around.
And we have one in Connecticut. We have the New England cottontail. So that is an endangered species. Rarely would you ever get one into captivity. The one time that they thought I had one, well, I thought I had one, and I contacted our DEEP because that's what you're supposed to do if you do think you have a New England cottontail. They thought I had one. It was the most stressful rehab I've ever undergone because every day they would contact me and ask me what the rabbit ate, how much the rabbit ate, how much the rabbit weighed. I was going to lose my mind with this little rabbit. And they actually came down and did a DNA test to my house. And she wasn't a New England cottontail, thankfully for her, because she was going to go into a breeding tank. And they do release them after 3 years, but she would be used to breed if they could have. And I also learned a lot about New England cottontails and how to identify them if I were to have one come into my center. But they're very difficult to identify, and it does require DNA testing to be absolutely certain.
Wow. Yeah, we don't have in Minnesota, where I am, you know, we have cottontails. We have some hares. We have, you know, certainly jackrabbits, things like that. But we don't have any endangered or threatened species of that. So, but we do of like bats or things. And
yeah,
a couple of the bats are very difficult to tell from each other.
Yep.
Except for a little measurement in their ear.
Well, that's like the New England cottontail. It's the occipital lobe. I think the shape of the skull. And obviously, if you have two of them together, the New England is a little smaller in size than the regular cottontail. And the ears are lined in black, right? Okay. But you can have Eastern cottontails with the ears lined in black, you know? Right. So, you know what I mean? Like it doesn't separate. And then where a lot of the Eastern cottontails that have gotten in have the white mark, right? The kiss.
Yes. Yep.
But these have a black mark. But the difference is that the one I had a black mark. But what the deep folks told me was that you go all the way down to the scalp, because for the New England cottontails, it should go down to the scalp, whatever this black mark is.
Okay.
So, you know, are there ways to pretty much identify maybe like with certainty? Yes, but they still require either feces or absolute DNA test to determine for sure if they're going to put them into a breeding program, right?
Oh, exactly. Exactly. They need to have that. Yeah, exactly right to do that. That's wow. Wow. Well, I'm learning a lot already. This is amazing. Ooh, yay. So, okay. We know why you rehabilitate rabbits and why rehabilitators do. And of course, cottontail rabbits are probably the number one rehabilitated animal in North America. Probably because a lot of them have become very urban. Mm-hmm. They've been forced to be urban, but also we create habitat for them. Mm-hmm. So that's why people intersect with them. The general public intersect with them. So let's say we have someone calls you up and they have baby rabbits. How do you talk to the finders? What are your techniques for figuring out whether or not this animal needs assistance or not? And what, you know, kind of teasing through the story, because all the finders have stories. Yeah. And they need to tell them, because no one is listening to them, but you have an ear that, because you want to know, right? Uh-huh. So how do you work with finders?
I think that's a really important question, because that's one of my guiding principles, which is the animal's always first. And as we know, the animal does best in the wild with the mom. There is no replacement for that. Mm-hmm. I listen to the finders. I always, if they text me or they email me, I always have them send me photos, whether it's of the nest.
So great. We can do that now.
Yes.
When I started in this business, oh no.
You couldn't. Yeah.
You couldn't. Yeah. No. It's like, is it the size of a basketball or a tennis ball?
Yeah. Is it a tennis ball?
Right. Anyway,
so
sorry.
I asked them to send me a photo. Because that's the first thing that's going to give me a clue as to, how educated they are about the rabbits and like what the scenario could possibly be, right? Mm-hmm. If it's something that's the size of a tennis ball, usually it's allowed to stay out on its own. And the only time I would ever take one of those in is if it was injured or cat caught, right? Mm-hmm. I really wouldn't take it in. I would have them move it under a bush and just let it go rather than take it in. But if it's a nest of kits, now it becomes a little bit more. You really have to suss out the client, not the client, the finder. Okay, we have to do that again.
No, I actually love it.
You have to suss out the finder, because, you know, when you say there's a story they tell you and there's the real story, you know, right. Oftentimes there's another layer. You know, the first thing is the mom hasn't been here. If I hear that, you know,
all
10 times.
The time.
And what they don't understand is that the mom only comes twice a day, maybe three times a day, or once a day if she's feeling distressed that there's something in the area that she doesn't trust and spooked. But normally it's two times a day, dusk and dawn, right? Mm-hmm. So they're not going to see the rabbit. They're not going to see mom. And every time they see a rabbit in their yard, they're like, well, maybe that's mom. Well, you don't even know who that rabbit is. That rabbit may just be passing through,
exactly.
Right? So in some instances, I've had really great finders who have set up cameras for me. And that was intense. And actually each time the mom did come back, which was awesome. But I also have them do a tic-tac-toe nest, and I don't have them do an X over the nest, because the mom can move in, nurse her babies and not disturb the X, depending on how big the nest is, right? But if you do a tic-tac-toe of the same substrate, like grass, blades of grass, and it doesn't have to be an exact tic-tac-toe, but like a mirage, a collage of pieces, so that you take a photo
and
then the next morning after sunrise, you check that photo and see if any of those blades of grass have been disturbed. Because that's going to let you know if the nest is still covered, that mom's been there. Okay. Right. So we don't have to disturb it. But if the nest remains the same, then it depends. And I've made this call twice. And fortunately, I've made it correctly because it's a little scary. You know, people are very often, once that happens, they're just like, well, we're going to take the rabbits. But I've had two occasions. One was a nor'easter and the weather was really awful. Okay. And the mom didn't come. And these are the people, actually, one of these people were one that set up a camera. The other was not. And so I said, let's wait another day. And that's really tricky because rabbits need the nutrition. So right. I was taking a big chance. The mm-hmm. weather was so bad, maybe mom couldn't get to them. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, the mom came and she fed them and she was there for both of those nests.
Wow.
So, you know, sometimes you have to go with your gut and my gut could have been wrong. I mean, I could have had babies that were really decompensating because of my choice, right? Mm-hmm. My decision mm-hmm. or telling mm-hmm. the finder. But I really had a gut feeling that, you know, it was horrific weather and maybe that's what kept her away. And why take them and put them into captivity and not give her the chance?
Right. So part of that gut is a lot of your experience, right?
Maybe, yeah.
Part of it is a guiding principle, right? Mm-hmm. We want to keep these animals in place if we can,
right.
if at all possible. And kind of trusting the system.
Yeah.
That's a phrase I've been using a fair amount, especially I do a lot of birds. And so when mm-hmm. I'm re-nesting and people are like, well, how are we going to know that they're feeding? Like, trust the system. Nature's been doing this for a very long time.
Yes. Yes.
So part of that was, just trusting the system. And sometimes are we going to get it wrong? Mm-hmm. We are. We're human. And we are not in that animal's world, you mm-hmm. know, exactly. But I think it's a good risk, especially with all those pieces in place, right?
Right.
Your experience, you had that weather, all those kinds of things. I think that was a good risk to take.
Yeah. And it turned out well, which I'm very happy. And actually, both of the finders were ecstatic. Because I got to watch the rabbits grow, the little kits, and they had kids, and they, you know, they used it as an experience family-wise, and it was so wonderful. So it was fabulous.
That's amazing. Okay, so talking to the finder, of course, is very important, right? You need to get their story and then kind of mm-hmm. tease out the real story there. And in there, then that's when you decide, does this animal need to come in or not? So when you're making those, what kinds of situations that are fairly common that the little kits find themselves in that may need care?
I would say cat caught, dog caught, and lawnmower, landscaping. Those are the three biggest.
Yeah.
And cat caught, if the kits are still in the nest and there's only like one that's outside the nest, I would probably leave the other ones and take the one, right? Okay. Rather than take all.
Okay.
If the nest is disturbed and there's any blood in the nest or anyone who's injured, I'd always remove them.
Okay.
I've had one instance where I don't remember exactly what happened. Maybe it was a lawnmower, but there was blood in the nest, but the kits were all fine except for one, obviously. Mm-hmm. That was the one that was bleeding. And we cleaned out the nest. Like, I had them pull the babies out and take the blood out of the nest. This soil and replace it with other soil and then place the babies back and whatever fur they could use. Because obviously the kits don't have a scent, but the blood will. Yeah. And also it may spook mom. Mm-hmm. You know, if she thinks her kits have been injured, she may not even think they're in there anymore. You know, I don't know how she would react.
Right.
So I've done that, but that's with a finder who's astute and who's absolutely heartbroken that this happened in the first place and is willing to go that mile. You had a lot of finders that aren't willing to do anything. And those are the tough cases. You know, my dog found a nest. It needs to go.
Because my dog has to go in the backyard.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm able to win them over and tell them that, you know, it's only 2 weeks, 3 weeks max, right? And mm-hmm. if you put a lawn chair over the nest during the day while your dog's romping around, just make sure it comes off prior to sunset.
So you lawn chair or laundry basket? What?
Either. Because for some dogs, they're big.
Okay.
And it really needs to be something where they can't move it.
Okay.
And so, yeah, whatever you can do to put over it so that you can protect the nesting area from that dog. Mm-hmm. But after sunrise and before sunset, not outside of those hours, mm-hmm. Because that's when mom's going to come through, right. More than likely.
Mm-hmm.
I've had them. I also have a question in my mind, and this is not something I can answer, but maybe someone else can, is I don't understand why so many dogs find the nest. I don't know if it's because the rabbits are moving in the nest, because that would be a cat thing for me, kind of.
Sure.
Or if they're really in distress, because dogs always know, you know, think about the dogs we trained for epilepsy, for all kinds of things, you know, bomb sniffing. I wonder if they can sense the distress, because oftentimes when the dogs find a nest, I end up having to pull the nest and okay. I don't know why.
Hmm. That's really
and interesting. I try to keep them in and the next day it's still mom hasn't come. And, you know, unless it's just a dog on a walk kind of thing, but if it's, you know,
sure.
it's just odd that it's always, huh. you know, those are the ones I find are the most often in distress. The mm-hmm. lawnmower ones are fine. The cat ones were fine. The mm-hmm. dog ones, a lot of them were in trouble.
Isn't that interesting?
And I don't know why. I don't know if there's any truth to it, but it's what I see.
Uh-huh. So, oh, man, you know, something to kind of start talking about. Because, mm-hmm. you know, like I said.
I'd be interested if other rehabbers have the same, you know, experiences. Mm-hmm. Is it more that the dogs do have a sixth sense, you know?
Right, not? Right. And, yeah, figure something out. Because you're right. We train them for all kinds of things. So.
Yep.
Why wouldn't
they
be able to?
And they sense stress and they mm-hmm. sense, you know, they do it even when they're not trained, you know,
right.
When, you know, there's something wrong with someone, you know, someone, mm-hmm. one person said they had cancer and the dog was sitting on top of her all the time and she didn't understand why. And then she went to the doctor and she, you know, and the dog had never done that before, you know, so there's right. like different things with dogs and stories that are uncanny. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, because they do have that sense that's much, their nose is much stronger than ours. And they're just, they're keener in a lot of ways than we are.
Right. Right. Yeah, there. Yeah, we don't rely on our nose and eyes.
Yeah.
I mean, we have them. We rely on them. We think they're great.
Right.
They are great, but not as great.
No. As I mean, a dog can, I mean, the sense of smell, but right. even like just their perceptiveness or their intuitive, you know, what they feel. I don't know if we rely on those instincts or those features, whatever, right. as much as dogs do.
Okay. So, you're trying to keep the babies in place. And I mean, what types of maybe action items? You said set up a camera, set up a tic-tac-toe. I love that, actually, and I'm going to adopt that.
I have a great tic-tac-toe photo if you want from one of my finders. She was amazing.
Yeah, we'll put that in our resources. Mm-hmm. So people yep. can have an idea yep. of
it's absolutely it's floating about. Around because people have found it in my presentations or I've sent it and like I see it, like I saw it in someone's presentation recently and I'm like, it's my photo.
Well, we'll give you perfect. Credit. We will totally give you credit.
No, but it's or perfect because at least the message is out there.
Yes. Yeah.
That's
certainly
it.
What we want. Right. That's what exactly what we want. So what are there other action items? Yes, keep your dog inside or keep it on a leash during those 2 weeks.
A couple weeks kind of thing. But I also, so let's say we're unsure of whether the mom's been there, mm-hmm. right? So now my next step for them would be to take one of the buns. And usually I tell them, just put your hands in soil, you know, so that you're kind of earthy. And then pick up the little baby because they're mm-hmm. like, do I have to wear gloves? And they can wear gloves if they'd like, but most of them don't wear gloves. But I just rather have it a little earthier than just, I don't know what their hands have been doing, you know, with chemicals.
Right.
Or.
Right.
So, and then I ask them to photograph. I usually prefer seeing the baby all like together, like a whole photo of the baby, because I can look at the eyes. Are they sunken? You know, right. certain things that you can notice. But I also always ask them to do the abdomen. Mm-hmm. Because this way I can tell if mom has been there, because if it's got a milk line, then definitely mom's been there, right? Mm-hmm. We don't have to worry. If there is no milk line, and this is what happened, I think, with the Nor'easter, there was no milk line, but the baby's stomachs were fine. They weren't all wrinkly. You know how the babies get dehydrated, right. and you dehydrated. Can tell they're wrinkly. These weren't wrinkly. They were perfectly fine. It's just that they hadn't eaten in probably 12 hours or 18 hours or whatever.
Right.
If that's the case, I might try again. You know, if it's to the point where their bellies are wrinkly, their eyes are sunken, they look, then I have them pull them. And then I give them instructions on what they need to do. As far as, you know, the three things I always tell them: dark, warm, quiet. Those are the three things I need.
That works for pretty much everything.
Yeah. Don't feed them. Don't touch them. You know, have them rolled in fleece. And I don't understand why people can't get the concept of rolling them into the fleece or letting them be inside the fleece. When I have finders, they always come, the fleece is on the bottom and the bunnies are on top. And I don't understand. Because they're like, well, won't they suffocate? I'm like, they're in the ground in a nest.
Covered.
What do you mean suffocate? You're just putting a little piece of fleece on top,
you know.
Or they arrive and they've got a refrigerator box with two rabbits, you know, little kids. And I'm just like, oh, that's traumatic. You know? And even if they were in the fleece, they're not there anymore. You know, I always try to call and get a shoebox. You know?
Right. Yeah, you want something to mimic as much as you can, right?
The nest.
Mimic the nest. And the nest is close and tight and dark, and they're helping keep each other warm
and
they're covered and quiet. So all of those things. So
yeah. And you want to cover, because that's another thing people don't do. And then they wonder why something's escaped in the car. You know, been down that road. And I tell people, you know, you don't underestimate, because when they're stressed, they can do a lot. You know,
they think it's their life.
Right.
And so they're
It kicks in and they are just, you know, all about escaping, survival.
Right. Survival. Okay. So this is great. So as far as action items for our finders, and here's a situation that I consider a natural situation, but it's happened to me several times. And you'll hear from a finder, I saved this baby from a crow.
Yeah.
What do you do in that situation?
I've had two situations like that just recently. And they were bigger rabbits, not kids.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one, it was two little boys, 8 and 10, that saved a rabbit from a hawk.
Okay.
And their mother brought it to where I work. Mm-hmm. Because everyone says, oh, just bring it here. Deb will take care of it. So I met them in the parking lot, and the rabbit had, you know, talon mark. He was really kind of degloved and looked terrible, poor thing. Sure. And obviously traumatized and petrified. Right. And the two little kids are there. So what am I supposed to say? Right. I didn't want to traumatize them. They felt like heroes. And I was like, you know, oh, I understand you boys saved this rabbit, you know, kind of thing. I said, well, let me tell you. You know, the hawk was looking for food, but the hawk dropped the rabbit. So that's why they saved it. Right.
Okay,
so, and the hawks do that. They will drop them to kind of knock them out. Right. Mm-hmm. So the boys did really honestly think they were saving the rabbit. So I couldn't chastise them on anything.
Oh gosh. Even, and never. Yeah.
No. And I would never want them to feel badly, but I'm thinking to myself, so now another rabbit's going to be gone. Yeah. But I said to the boys and their mom, I said, look, I will take the rabbit inside, because the first thing I did was do a quick exam. First thing I want to make sure, do the 4 feet work, right? Four legs, four paws, whatever. And I wanted to make sure the back felt to me that it was intact, the whole lining of the back, the spine. Okay. Mm-hmm. So those two things felt okay to me. So I said to the family, I said, look, I'm going to bring the rabbit in. I'm going to have one of our criticalists look at it for me, because she will, even though we don't do wildlife. Just so everybody knows, Cornell does not do wildlife.
Right.
But I happen to have friends there. So I asked her to look at it with me, and she agreed there was no spinal. And I had told the boys and the family that if there was a spinal fracture, a pelvic, you know, fractures, that I was going to euthanize immediately, because it's not fair to the rabbit, and we'll never be able to rehab this rabbit because it's an adult. It's not going to last in captivity or stay still for us. But if not, I will take it home and I can take care of the degloving. Sure enough, I was able to take it home and take care of the degloving, and the boys were like thrilled over the moon. So we did save the rabbit. I did release the rabbit.
Wow.
The second one happened 3 days ago. There was a call to one wildlife person who suggested me. The person contacted me. They said they could get there in 18 minutes. The rabbit only had a degloving on the top of its head, and it was a hawk attack.
Okay.
So I said, okay. They brought me the rabbit in a box, and the whole bottom of the box was like bloodied. And I'm like, okay, so there's more going on than just what's on the top of the head.
Right.
So I picked up the rabbit. All of the rabbit's internal organs came out.
Oh my God.
And the rabbit's alive. And I looked at the woman and I grabbed the box and I just said, I'm sorry, I'm going inside. This needs to be humanely euthanized now. And I ran inside and just yelled for a doctor, and the doctors came out and euthanized him immediately. But I was just like, I've done that where I've scooped something up and, in a blanket and not looked, because, you know, you're just getting it out of danger, right? The middle of the road.
Right.
So I understood what she did. And I told her, you know, I explained to her, I've done the same thing, you know, but again, the hawk dropped the rabbit. So, you know, it's like people don't understand the natural predatory of how the hawk hunts, how the, you know, so there's more education that's needed, because then I think they would leave the rabbit was going anyway, you know, so they would leave the rabbit.
Right. Right.
So we had one good outcome and one not so good.
Not so good. Yeah. And it depends on the good outcome, from that rabbit, that first rabbit.
Yeah.
The hawk, of course, had to do more hunting to find food to feed its family.
And another rabbit had to be taken. So now two had to be traumatized.
Right.
The bad thing about the one that had to be euthanized, but I don't remember what it was.
That's quite all right. So now we have some common situations, and now you determine that the kits need to come in for care. So when you get them in, what are the very first things you do?
The first things I do is I know they're traumatized, because I know whatever directions I gave the finder were not followed correctly.
And even if they were followed, it's got to be still traumatizing.
So they're in a car and I tell them no sound. You know that they were talking on the phone or had the radio on.
There's
no way a driver, like a wildlife rehabilitator, would drive to my house for 40 minutes and not have some form of entertainment. I'm sorry. It just doesn't happen. They're just not going to tell you. It doesn't happen. And they're like, well, we were talking softly, you know? Yeah. Okay. So immediately I take the rabbits from them. And the first thing I want to do, if they're not bleeding kind of thing or needing immediate attention, I put them in heat in my fleece, and I let them stay there for about 20 minutes at least.
Sure.
Just quiet, calm, warm, because the warmth is the key. And obviously these babies have been cold, warm, you know, in the time frame that we've been dealing with. So I get them warm. And what I say to people is, you know, when I take them out to assess them, you know, I kind of do a quick physical, and sometimes the physical's longer, but you always do it the same way. So if you're starting with the head, and then both the feet are fine, the back is fine, they look fine, their feet are fine, there's no wounds, you know, there's no wounds on the abdominal side, that's great. But if the rabbit starts to get cold, or the rabbit starts to really stress, I put them back on heat. It's not so important that I get all that info at one time, right? It's more important that the rabbit stays comfortable. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, if you're dealing with kits and all, you're looking at the eyes, to see, are there any wounds or issues? How dehydrated might they be? You know, that kind of thing. It's mostly when you get the older rabbits, there might be other things going on, degloving and things like that, maggots, you know, all those friends. But usually with the kits, it's a little simpler. And then if they're cat caught, obviously, it's important that they get medication, antibiotics.
So working with your veterinarian, because there are certain, if our listeners aren't aware.
In the state of Connecticut, you have to have a wildlife vet that works with you. Yep. So my wildlife vet works with me. Right now, she's not really seeing any wildlife because of all the zoonotic, or not even zoonotic, but all the diseases that are out there, whether it's RHDV2 or, you know, like the avian flu, because they do exotics, right? So you can't be working on birds in your hospital and have something come in that's wild that's now going to transport something that can take it.
Exactly. But my guess is that you have figured out standard operating procedures with your vet.
Yep.
So that
she knows exactly. And she also has been working with me for several years. So she knows that anytime I brought her anything, that's another thing. Never waste your vet's time, right? Mm-hmm. If you're bringing your vet something, it either needs, I know it needs to be euthanized. Okay, I would bring that to my vet. I think there might be a back fracture, a pelvic fracture. I need your expertise. Otherwise, I can euthanize, right? So use your vet's time wisely. They're there to help, but they also have other things to do and they're very busy. So I try, and with my vet, she knows how I work. I am not going to bring her something unless I really have a problem with it.
Right.
And so she appreciates that. So if I call her and say, like, I don't want to get anyone in trouble, but I had a rabbit that had come in. It was a weed whacking accident and had its throat slashed. And I needed Pengen, because he had aspiration pneumonia and I couldn't get it in time. Mm-hmm. And I called her and I said, I know you're not seeing the rabbits, but I had this rabbit that could have lived, but I didn't have the proper and I couldn't bring him to you. So she actually did give me some PenGen so that I have it in my store, you know, my stock.
Well, so you so have it on hand. So you had a small prescription, whatever. And again,
it's tiny. It's not a huge amount, but it would get me to where I need to be until I could get to her or whatever.
Right. You know? And the other thing that I'm totally taking from this conversation about your veterinarian is you built a relationship.
Yes.
With your veterinarian.
That's it. I don't just go to her door and drop something off. It's not like that. You know, and I know it's tough to get wildlife vets. And this is a big thing with rehabilitators, especially in our state, because you have to have one.
Yep,
and I think it's a mutual respect. Like you really have to respect your veterinarian, respect their time and know your craft. And if you don't know your craft or you don't know an answer, you can also look in a book. There's research. You know, we have plenty of things available. Ask network, one of your network people, ask them, post it on like a, you know, a wildlife page like Wild Buns. Post it onto that site so that people can weigh in and say, this is what I think you need to go to a vet immediately. You know, like there's ways to narrow it down if you're a newer person that's rehabbing. I get calls from everywhere. I get them across the country at any time of the day or night sometimes. And people will say, can I send you a photo or can you weigh in on this? I just had someone weigh in the state of Connecticut, who's I think is a really good rehabilitator. And, but again, she questions her bunny talents and, she had received a rabbit that was, most of us would say it had head tilt, right? But it was a kit, right? I was like, I mean, not a newborn, probably, I don't know, a week and a half, 2 weeks, maybe 2 weeks old. And people had told her to euthanize it. Well, that's something you euthanize. And I said to her, hold on. I said, if it's a kit, my gut is to give it a little time as long as it's improving.
Right.
Because it's probably a head trauma. The cat had had it. So if the cat and the woman said, no, the cat didn't have it in its mouth. I'm like,
yeah,
oh,
I don't believe that.
I said, so you can believe that or not, but if the cat's, you know, shook the rabbit, she might've done some damage to, you know, and I said, so to put him on meloxicam because it's an anti-inflammatory, keep him on the antibiotic because of the cat. And 2 weeks later, this rabbit is running around the cage normal. It's not like turning in circles. It's not like with its head cocked to the side. It's totally normal. It's like fighting to be released.
Right.
So
just needed that supportive care.
And, it was worth it to give it supportive care. And that's what she wanted to do. But she felt like she was up against, I think, a wall where people were saying, no, it needs to go. It needs to go kind of thing.
Sure.
And it didn't need to go. So, you know, I tried to, and I said to her, if you do this for another 4 days or something and you stop seeing any improvement, like we're not seeing improvement, then there's a time to stop.
Yep.
But if you're still seeing improvement, I mean, he's not doing it. I mean, it's not a lot of work, really. You know what I mean? It's giving the medications, but the rabbit's older. It's not a, you know, a newborn kit. So, and I find actually the adult rabbits that I get in are easier for me to work with sometimes than the kits. Which is ironic. You wonder, right?
You wonder. Oh my gosh. Okay. Excellent. And definitely, you know, shout out to the vets that help us and shout out that, boy, do we still need more?
We need
more rehabilitators. We need more veterinarians.
See, that's the thing. I don't know what vets fear. Like I had brought, I had a different vet initially and he handled all my domestic rabbits. And I brought him a wild rabbit and he wouldn't touch it, put it on the ground. And I put it on the ground and his diagnosis or outcome was correct because I did bring it to the vet I have now as a second opinion, but he wouldn't even touch it, you know? And so I don't know if it's a fear because they don't know what to do with them or they don't know how to handle them or they're afraid they're going to have some contagion. Like, I don't know what that is.
Sure.
But I think if they're more open to it, and I think a lot of the younger vets that are coming through do have some exotic experience. I think it's a little different because I find them, when we used to have them on it, we had a lot of younger vets on at Cornell, and they would always call me. We have an owl. I don't want to euthanize it. You know, can you help? And then I would step in, you know?
Right.
So, you know, when you get that kind of a thing and they would get permission from the powers that be, to hold it overnight in isolation so I could come pick it up and transport.
Right.
But they would keep it alive, whether it's fluids or whatever, but they knew how to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of them don't know how to, how do you give fluids to a bird and a wing? You know what I mean? Like, I don't know how to do it. You know, I would never do it. I would bring it to someone, But right. So that's the kind of thing. I think it's training. I think it's being comfortable, you know.
Right.
And then also having the relationship with the rehabber. Because I think a lot of rehabilitators feel like it's almost like a hot potato. You know, they go running to the vet every 5 minutes with something.
Sure.
And that's not a relationship and you're not learning. And in a way, it's kind of dumping. And that's not fair to anybody, not right. even the animal.
Exactly.
And if the
exactly.
animal comes first, that's not fair for the animal.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, that relationship, it's kind of this that three-legged stool we deal with. We veterinarians, the rehabilitators, the regulatory bodies, right?
Oh, yeah. And that's, the public.
And the public. So four-legged
yeah.
stool.
Yeah, it is a four-legged
And the animal
stool.
Is kind of in the middle, right? Because yep. yep. that's what connects all of them is yep. that particular animal.
So. And the thing is, everyone cares about the animal.
Mm-hmm. But differently right? sometimes, yeah. right?
Right.
They all have different concerns or inputs for that particular animal.
Correct.
So yeah.
So it's really kind of interesting dynamic.
Very interesting dynamic. Okay. So you got them in. Mm-hmm. You have let them kind of settle. I call it black mm-hmm. boxing, you know, for 10 to 20 minutes, nice mm-hmm. and warm, dark, quiet, like you would also tell a finder to do. But, you, right. of course, you want to do it again, unless, yeah. of course, there's an emergency situation.
Correct.
Then you take care of that. Okay. So now let's say we have, and maybe what we'll do is kind of go through the different stages of development okay. if we've got a young one. But now you've determined that this particular kit is healthy. Okay. You know, besides maybe some dehydration.
Yeah.
You know,
well, and dehydration's key because for yep. rabbits, I mean, most animals, but especially for rabbits, if they're not hydrated enough, they're not going to absorb anything. And the right. only thing you're going to do is glut up that gastrointestinal.
Sure.
You know, if you start putting in medications, like even the antibiotics for cats, you know, the cat for cat caught, I always hydrate first. It's going to take you a few seconds longer. The medication can wait that long. And you yes. want to get something in that gut that's going to hydrate. And my initial is usually electrolytes. I use Electrostat, I think, from Fox Valley, maybe.
Yeah, Fox Valley.
But I also yeah. will make my homemade electrolytes because there's a formula for that with a certain, you have, obviously have to use the measurements correctly or you lose the electrolyte kind of
Well, maybe
viability.
We can get that recipe and yes, we will put absolutely. That in the resources.
Yeah. yeah.
Okay.
Because if I'm in a pinch, I will use that. You know, if you're somewhere out on the street and you're near somebody and I can say, do you have salt, sugar, and distilled water? And we'll go into that too, because distilled water is really good for rabbits, for probably most animals, but at least bottled water or something, but mm-hmm. Because tap water has so many different elements, but and then you can mix it. Usually okay. you're mixing too much and you're gonna have to toss it, but you can get what you want for that two milliliters or whatever.
Right, right, right.
But that's all I care about at that point is getting it in. You can also do Pedialyte, although I only do the natural Pedialyte. Like I don't do the flavors that are Flavored. Artificial. I don't like it. For the rabbits, I don't like doing anything artificial for any animals, but especially rabbits. They're too delicate. And that goes with one of my things, which is less is more, one of my guiding principles.
Right, your guiding principles. Yeah, we're going to be sprinkling these.
Yes, and they're just, you know, all my guiding principles. Because what I do okay. is I take them out, make sure they're warm, and I make sure everything's prepared. So the Pedialyte and everything is all prepared. It's warming. The little heating pad is set up with the fleece. Everything is set up. My scale is here. It's all set up. So the rabbit only has to be out for the maximum time they're going to be out is the least amount of time I can do everything in rather than keeping them out and keeping them cold.
And that's a good principle for any wildlife rehabilitation, yeah. right? Is you take that time when they're being black boxed to get everything quietly ready.
Yep.
Or the your medications,
your medications, I pull them into the syringes. Like I have everything ready to minimize the time that rabbit is out of warmth. Okay. Mm-hmm. Even though they're on the heating pads, but they're out of their safety or their security.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm not playing, working them around. So I will first weigh them. I always weigh them first. And I'm neurotic about weight. Sorry, but I am.
Yep, I am.
So
too.
I will weigh them. Then I stimulate them. And I stimulate them because this is going to tell me a couple things. It's going to tell me how dehydrated they are, number one. It's going to tell me how healthy they are, because if it's clear straw, obviously maybe they shouldn't have been taken in the first place, because that means mom has been there pretty recently.
And usually, Deborah's referring to the color.
The color of the urine.
The color of the urine. Yeah.
Usually what I find, it's got some charcoal, a brown cocoa color to it. And that's really a highly stressed, could be they haven't been stimulated in a while and the toxins have built up. It could be a number of things. Could be an injury. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that can tell me some things. And I'm neurotic enough to have a scale of how I rate the color of urine.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
And then I weigh them. I weigh them again because now they've excreted all that urine. So I weigh them again. And then I will proceed with the, you know, the hydration and if they need the medication. And then immediately they go back into their little box and they stay there. And I go through all of them same way. Oh, and I weigh them after I give them the Pedialyte as well, just because. And then when they come out again, which will probably be in about, I don't know, maybe an hour, not that long. I'm going to start with, if they're all good, I'm going to start with 25% formula, 75% water.
Okay.
And I'll try that. Usually they are not amenable to that. They actually like the Pedialyte better than that. But even if they'll only take, like if it's a 40 gram rabbit, let's say, and they'll only take 1 ml of the 25% formula, I don't care. It's okay. Mm-hmm. Because I'm going to take them out again pretty quickly because they're on the formula now, right? So I can take them out again and give them 50 in like half an hour or so. Because by the time I get through the other four, you know, I'm rotating them.
Right.
So I don't mind. As long as he gets something in, he starts acclimating to what the new formula is going to be in the new routine. But again, when I take them out, I weigh them first. I stimulate. I give them the formula. And I weigh them first, stimulate, weigh them, give them the formula and weigh them again. So there's three weights every time I take them out in between everything. So
but the very first time you're taking them out, then you're doing the electrolyte.
Correct.
Solution.
The second time I'm not, but I leave about an hour because you don't want to mix the electrolytes with the formula. And you never make your formula with the electrolytes because I've heard some rehabilitators making formula with the electrolytes. Don't do it. Number one. You're losing the effect of the electrolytes because it's now all out of ratio from a chemistry perspective. Number two, I don't know how it mixes in their digestive system when it's together. I just wouldn't chance it. So do it separately. Mm-hmm. And when we were talking about, I was talking about distilled water. I find, and this was in my advanced rabbit presentation that I did a lot of research on, that the water that we use, everybody's water is different. You know, when people, rehabilitators like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm finding this with the rabbits. They're all dying. Oh, it must be the formula. Like there are so many variables in the situation. You're all using your water. Every water is different. You're all like, you can't narrow it down to just the formula on a flip. Right.
Right.
But one thing I will say about formula, if you're buying formula on like Amazon or something, and the price is like half price, if it's too good to be true, it is. They could be knocking it off. It's not what you're going to get from whoever the manufacturers are or the Chris's Squirrels and More, wherever you order your formula. So you want to get it through a reputable source. I would never purchase something that was half off through Amazon. I don't care. It's a great deal, but I'm going to sacrifice my rabbits and I spent too much time and I'm not doing it.
Right, right.
But with that, so the distilled water is what I use now. And the reason I use it is because everyone's water is different. So if you have like well water or something and you're really sure of your water, that's fine. But most of us have tap water and even our bottled water isn't this pure, right? And it can have minerals, which the rabbits do need the minerals, some of the minerals, but it has chlorine, could have radon, could have so many things in your water, rust, you know, from the pipes, anything. And look at the rabbit you're feeding and it doesn't take much of whatever that material is to affect this little body, right? That has nothing.
Right, the contaminant.
Yes. So if you're using distilled water, it's like vaporized and put into another container, right? And all the materials that could be contaminants stay in the old section. So distilled water is actually pure water.
Sure.
And that's what I will feed them, the pure water. Usually the formulas have a mineral content. And you can check it. And that's another thing that we can talk about is formula, because that's a biggie.
Yeah.
But the water being pure, I think, has a positive effect on the rabbits. Because remember, they have nothing in their digestive tract. And if you're getting them really tiny, really young, and they haven't spent enough time with mom to have their, you know, their gastro tract lined with those good antibodies, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
even the colostrum, you know, I just read again in this advanced rabbit presentation that colostrum obviously is extremely important to the rabbits, but only like the first day, the first 24 hours. So people that are getting a rabbit in and they're, you know, 3-4 days old, using the colostrum is not going to help. It's the initial. I don't know what the name of it is, but I did buy a form of colostrum that's safe for rabbits that I have in case if I get them in that first day that I can give to them. It's cow, of course, bovine, but it's probably better than nothing, you know?
Right.
That's what I found in my research. You know, when I talk about less is more, and we can talk about when we get to formula, but there's a couple of things that are okay to add to formula. And there are a lot of things that are not okay to add to formula.
That was Deb Galley, a Connecticut-based wildlife rehabilitator who specializes in caring for North American cottontail rabbits. Thanks for tuning in. We had a very detailed discussion, so we divided it into two parts. In part two, we continue on to discuss care after intake, formulas, feeding techniques, digestive health, wound healing, pre-release conditioning, and of course, release. Lots of valuable information to come, so I hope you'll join us for episode 4. Wildlife Rehabilitation from Rescue to Release is a production of Partners for Wildlife, working hand in hand with wildlife rehabilitators and veterinarians to improve the welfare of orphaned, ill, and injured wildlife. Our executive producer is me, Gail Buell. I'm the partnership coordinator for Partners for Wildlife at the University of Minnesota, College of Veterinary Medicine's Raptor Center. To learn more about the Raptor Center and Partners for Wildlife, visit raptor.umn.edu. Our producer is Kirk Klocke. Special thanks to our guest Deborah Galley, Partners for Wildlife, and the Raptor Center at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine. And that's our show. Hope you'll join us again next time.